Hey there, dog people of the internet. It's Sarah Stremming, the Cog Dog Coach, and this is Cog Dog Radio. Join me as I cover behavior concepts, discuss training ideas, interview experts, and explore my cases, all regarding the dogs we live and play with. Let's go. This week, I'm joined by Dr. Angie Johnston, who is an assistant professor of psychology at Boston College, where she is the director of the Canine Cognition Center and Social Learning Laboratory. Y'all, I loved talking to Angie about the work that she's doing. I think that you know that I think dogs are just the coolest things on earth. And the stuff that Angie is finding out in the lab about the way that they learn from us confirms coolest things on earth. It's just so awesome what we can find out when we devote science to this amazing animal. Enjoy our conversation. I know I did.
Welcome to the podcast. Will you share your name and pronouns with us?
Yes, my name is Angie Johnston, and my pronouns are she, her, hers.
Awesome. So thank you so much for joining me today. You have done and are actively doing some very exciting research. Will you give us a brief overview of what you have going on right now in the lab?
Yes, we have a couple different lines of research going on right now. Some of what we're doing is trying to understand dogs, and some of what we're trying to do is actually understand people. And some of the work we're doing right now to try to understand dogs is to understand what are they trying to communicate with us. So in particular, there is a very common behavior that dogs use to communicate with us, which is eye contact and eye gaze. And they can tell us a lot with their eyes. But we're wanting to figure out, are we over-anthropomorphizing what their eyes are doing? Or are they actually doing what we think they're doing? And so we're doing some work trying to figure out if dogs are making eye contact sometimes because they're seeking help, or if they're affiliating with us, or if they're just looking at us because we're interesting and something that's sitting there. So we have some work that's trying to tease that apart.
That's really, really interesting. I think eye contact is one of those, it's almost a hot topic in dog training. Like, some people are really opposed to training active eye contact from the dog. Some people like cornerstone their entire program on eye contact. Won't it be interesting if we can kind of find some things out as far as what dogs think about eye contact, like where they're actually coming from on that?
Exactly. What is their intuitive behavior showing? What are they trying to communicate with that?
Because I've definitely had situations where, like, I definitely think my dogs look into my eyes for help, like you said, like they need
absolutely.
Something.
It feels that way for sure.
It feels like they're trying to say, like, one of my dogs, Raya, will come and she will just stare in my face. And like, I know that she needs something and I have to then go figure out what it is that she needs. Usually it's an outside need. Like, usually it's, I need to go out, and I like it a lot better than barking. So I try to reward it by, by taking care
absolutely.
Of whatever it is. So that's something you guys are actively investigating right now.
Yes, exactly. And the way we do that is we have a task that is very difficult to solve. And we see, are the dogs trying to recruit someone who's helping them versus someone who's affiliating with them?
Can you talk about the difference between affiliating and helping?
Yes. Like,
they're obviously, not the same, but tell me what you mean so that everybody can kind of, I guess, see what that distinction is in the lab.
Absolutely. Yes. So helping is providing concrete behavior that helps you reach your goal. So as an example, that's not what we're doing in the lab. Imagine a dog has a ball and rolls under the couch. We've all seen this happen before, right? And that's a behavior, the time where you see the behavior of eye contact. And so mimicking our lab findings in the home environment, then the person would help the dog get the ball, reach under the couch and get the ball. Versus an affiliation would be, oh, you're such a good boy. What a good boy you are. And see, does the dog continue to try to make eye contact with you when you are helping them versus just telling them they're a good boy? And so our thinking is that if it's something they need help with and you just keep telling them they're a good boy, they might stop doing the behavior.
Absolutely. In fact, I tell people, especially not so much in eye contact, but if their dog is barking at them for a reason, like the ball went under the couch, I tell people to praise them and pet them because of the frequency with which it makes the behavior stop because it's not what they wanted.
That's a really great anecdote. That's really interesting.
Yeah, so it's fascinating that you guys are examining literally what I have advised.
That's great. Well, we'll get to find out. We're still collecting data, so I don't know what the results are, but...
Well, and I bet it varies, right? Like, I bet it's different, right? Like, they're not a monolith. Like, they are individuals.
So true.
Yeah.
And that's something that we're really excited about. Right now, the field of canine cognition is so young that there's only so many answers to so many questions that we have. But once we lay the groundwork, it'll be so exciting to go back and check things like individual differences, breed differences, with follow-up studies that have larger samples.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's important to point out because sometimes from the non-science community, a criticism that I hear is like, well, you didn't look at this. And well, you didn't. And like, it's so important to explain that like, you cannot control for everything up front. Mm-hmm. Like you have to get kind of this baseline little bit of information and then from there do more exploring. And like it's a young field, so you're building those baselines of information.
Exactly. And it takes a lot of building block. It's like a puzzle or a sculpture is how I've heard people describe it, where you're taking one piece and you're building on another piece to get a bigger picture, but it takes time.
And so you mentioned, and I find this really interesting, that you also look at human learning. Like you're also trying to understand humans better. And you're doing some, are you doing comparisons between humans and dogs? And
exactly.
Yeah, so talk about that.
Yes. So what we do is we compare human children, usually about preschool aged, to dogs. And we identify aspects of human learning we know exist. So, for example, one of the main ones that we've been studying recently is called over-imitation. And what this is when you show human children a puzzle box that has a lot of different features, and you show them some silly, unnecessary steps, they still copy you. They copy all the steps you show them, whether they're silly or not. And people have argued this might be a unique aspect of human learning because we've compared humans to chimpanzee on this sort of behavior. Mm. But chimpanzees are actually quite different from humans in how they learn from us. Whereas dogs are very similar to humans in how they learn from us. We already talked about eye contact. So eye contact is a major source of affiliation. We know it's not, the question is it also helping, like we talked about before, but it's important for affiliation. It's also important for communication. Dogs are able to follow our eye gaze to know where to go and follow pointing from even 4 weeks of age. And so we know that dogs are very ready to learn from us in the same way that our human children are. But then the question becomes, what pieces of human learning are still unique, even compared to dogs? And so that's where we start comparing dogs and humans to carve out, okay, this part is shared with dogs. Then we take that, and we can talk about this more later too. We compare the dogs to dingoes to see how this might have evolve. And then we find some things that are unique, that maybe special parts of human learning that explain why we have, like, dogs are incredible, but they're not sitting here on a Zoom conversation, you know, having on laptops that were created by their conspecifics.
So, thank goodness, to be honest. Thank goodness. My border collies, I don't know.
What would they talk about?
Yeah. What would they be doing? So, okay, I got to back it up a little bit. Dogs are a better model for human learning than chimpanzees. Is that what you're
yes.
saying that?
That's
that
I'm
is
saying, yes.
fascinating. And it feels like, let me see if I got this right. It feels like the reason that might be is because dogs are set up, have like uniquely evolved to learn from us, and our human children also have uniquely evolved to learn from us versus chimpanzees. Nothing to do with humans. There's no evolution of learning from a human, but they learn from each other, obviously. And it is a different way of learning than they might learn from us. Am I getting this
exactly.
right?
Exactly. You're getting it right, but I think that's exactly right. And even the ways chimpanzees learn from each other are very different than how humans learn from each other. So, for instance, chimpanzees don't seem to have cues that signal communicative intent, meaning that they don't have things. Eye contact is very aggressive for chimpanzees, and they don't use things like, if you're trying to teach a baby something, you make eye contact with the baby, use that high-pitched, baby, baby, look at this, high-pitched voice. And that seems to signal to babies and to children that you're teaching them something. Chimpanzees don't have any of those sort of intentional cues, so they're just kind of eavesdropping on each other. They're learning through happenstance. They're not learning by teaching each other things. And so
they're not intending to educate, we don't think.
Correct, yes.
Interesting.
And so whereas humans are able to do that, dogs have learned through evolution. They figured out how to be receptive to human communication in the same way that human children are.
Okay. And so when you talk about dog learning, you are specifically talking about dogs learning from us, not from each other. Or do you also look at that?
We look a little bit. We're starting to look at that, actually. We have a new study we're doing that involves two dogs from the same household, where we're comparing how they learn from each other versus how they learn from humans.
That's really interesting.
We don't have any data on that yet. But again, dogs for each other don't have those cues that signal I'm teaching you.
That's what I was imagining. You're talking about the chimps, and you're talking about, they do learn from each other, but they, it's like the learning is happening, but the teaching is not.
Right.
And then with dog to dog, the learning is happening, but the teaching is not.
Exactly.
And so this is a really fascinating thing that dogs can do, actually, because it's not a quote unquote natural part of their world, I guess. Like if their world is void of humans, this isn't there, but they're ready. Like you said, as young as 4 weeks, they can pick up on some of these cues. That is amazing to me. So what do you do with the dingoes? Like you also, you're looking at dingoes. Is that a comparative situation of like these live wild, are not domesticated like our dogs are? And so that's a model to look at, to explore what are the differences.
Yes. And there's even a tad bit longer version where, some people compare to wool, and wolves haven't undergone any domestication, but dingoes have undergone through evolution a taming process whereby they are comfortable being around humans. But they haven't ever been artificially selected by humans, meaning they haven't been bred by humans.
Okay.
So they allow us to see what is a tame animal that's not been bred to be a dog.
So it's kind of, it's naturally selected for the tameness because it co-mingles with humans so much in its natural life.
Yes. And it actually, the story goes back even farther to Asia before Australia, where humans were starting to live together in camp. And it seems like the density of humans led to a high density of trash, which was very tempting for some wolf-like animals to go in and eat this trash. But it's also terrifying because you have humans you have to go up against. So only the tamest ones would go into camps, and then they would mate together. And their puppies would be more tame. This kept happening for generations. But it is a fully natural selective process. It's not humans breeding them.
Yes. And so they're a good model because of this kind of naturally selected for tameness to explore some of these themes. What can you give us a snapshot of, like, what's the difference between the dingoes and the dogs that you look at?
Yes. So I would say the biggest difference is the dingoes are not nearly as socially motivated as the dogs are. So
makes sense.
The dingoes will make eye contact with people, but they do so for much shorter durations than dogs. And that's just one, that's eye contact is such a cornerstone and easy to code behavior that I think that captures a lot of different differences in the social motivation. The dingoes also are, we have some evidence to suggest that they might be better problem solvers than dogs, that because they don't have this reliance on humans, they have this more reliance on self. So they're more independent and able to solve more puzzles and things like that.
That makes perfect sense. Like the dogs have learned that we will help them solve problems, and the dingoes have not. And so they are solving their own problems. And I could see, you know, as this body of research grows, examining differences across breeds, because this is something I certainly hear from folks who have breeds that they kind of label primitive, like Basenjis.
Yes.
And talking about how the Basenjis might rate more like the dingoes in, like, we obviously don't know this yet, but it would be an interesting thing to explore.
Oh, absolutely. That's something I really want to explore because there's already some, with eye contact, there's some really interesting evidence suggest these more ancient breeds like Basenjis make less eye contact than more modern breeds. And so it makes sense if you're seeing this trade-off happening, which I think we might be, that's just a theory. We need a lot more research to back that part up. But I would completely agree that I would expect a Basenji to perform more independently and thus more successfully.
Yeah, or even like, I have two breeds in my house. I have Border Collies and I've had Border Collies a really long time. And Border Collies, obviously, really, really highly specialized breed that works with humans. And that's why I have them, because they're really good at sports and I like to play sports with my dogs. And I really enjoy training them. They also, I mean, some of them, like you were talking about these kind of in like these intuitive cues, like some of them feel like they are literally reading my mind in a training session. They are amazing. Mm-hmm. Then I also have an Icelandic sheepdog, which is technically an ancient breed. So we think dates back to the Vikings and not as designed to work under human direction. It's called a sheepdog, but it's called a sheepdog because like it's an all-purpose farm dog and people put that word on the breed. They can and do work sheep, but it's completely different than Border Collies. And she and her problem solving and her capabilities are like, she's completely different than them. She will solve a problem for herself before asking me, and they will just ask me. And she was more confident and bold in the environment way earlier than them. Just so many different, really, really interesting different things. I hope that you get to really dig into some of those breed differences.
I hope so too. And I think that some of the breed comparison work is really challenging because you need so many of a particular breed. But if you're looking at these ancient breeds versus modern breeds, then you're looking at breed groups, which makes it a little bit more tenable logistically as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I would love for you to look at like sighthounds in a general, like just looking at this at sighthounds versus, you know, other types of dogs that are maybe that are not as primitive, not as ancient, more selectively designed by us, but not designed to work for us. Like, like a lot of the scent type of hounds, like that would be fascinating to kind of see what those differences are. We've talked about eye contact and kind of pointing a little bit, and you talked about one study, but can you talk a little bit more just about the actual procedures and how you're exploring the way that dogs learn? Because I think it's really cool because it's kind of a citizen science situation. Like you don't have a bunch of dogs living in kennels. Like these are dogs that get to come and play these cool games. So talk about
it. Yeah. So our main go-to is we design puzzles that are specifically set up for the questions that we're asking. So for instance, with over-imitation, we have essentially a transparent box that has a lid on top that can be knocked off and a lever that comes out the side that looks like kind of like a transparent stick. And then we just see when we're looking at if dogs do unnecessary steps, we can actually make it so that in some cases the stick is relevant and in other cases the lid is relevant by where we place the treat. And so if we put the treat inside of the box, the lever is actually just swinging there, doing nothing. All you need to do is get the lid off.
Okay.
And then if we bait the lever, you hit the lever and it knocks the treat out. And then the lid is just sitting there doing nothing. And so we can see what we find when we demonstrate to the dogs both the unnecessary action and the necessary act. And what we find is that by the end of these trials, we give them four trials, the dogs have learned the most efficient way to solve the problem, and they just do that. So they're leaving out the unnecessary step in a way that children, when we compare to human children just continue copying across all the trials.
Do dogs do the copying at all, or do they just
they do a little bit?
Okay.
When they copy, not at large rates, only about 30% of the dogs in this study.
Interesting.
Did it. Once they figure it out, it was 0% of dogs doing it at the end.
Once they solve it, they don't listen. They're like, okay, well, you're doing stupid things.
Exactly. Like, why would I do that? I want the treat as fast as possible.
Yeah, for sure. What are some of the other cool games?
So we do pointing. We have these, basically, they're kind of like solo cup where they're opaque and you can't see. And we train dogs up on that when they touch a cup, we lift it for them and they get whatever's under it, whether it's a treat or nothing. And so they learn this over a course of several trials. And then we put the cups out and we point at one of them. And we see, do dogs follow pointing? And the dogs do follow pointing when we do that. And so a lot of people say to me, you know, when I try this at home, my dog doesn't really do it. And it's, they're not doing this 100% of the time. And it's not 100% of dogs doing it. But when we compare them, they're statistically significantly higher than chance.
Right, right. And that's another kind of important thing to disseminate, I think, to like the non-science community is like, when we say dogs follow pointing, we say that like a statistically significant amount of dogs are following yes. pointing, not like 100% of them 100% of the time. Have you, exactly. I've heard a little bit about the pointing and I've seen some videos of this puzzle, I think. Have you explored the difference between like who's doing the pointing versus not, like a person the dog knows versus not?
I haven't done that, but there have been other people.
Okay, so that's why I've heard of that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And in general, whenever you have someone who's familiar to the dog, they are more likely to do a lot of these behaviors, but they're still able to do it with people that they don't know.
And that's interesting too, that they can do it with a new person. Probably their comfort level in the whole situation matters.
And that's one thing that we take really seriously in our lab. Like you mentioned, people bring their dogs in. So we just have pet dogs that are coming in from around the Boston area. And we have an initial visit that we do that's just a meet and greet at the lab where they get to see some of our study materials that we use and meet us and smell the space and get to realize this is not the vet. They can be relaxed. It's not the groomer, that it's a fun place where they're, it's all about them and they're getting treats. And I think that really makes a big difference in how willing they are to participate in our studies after that.
I could imagine that there might be a variable in which dogs that are kind of fearful of new places get kind of, they don't get involved in the program. Like if they're too scared, yes. you don't keep them in. And it would probably be interesting to know what the differences are with those dogs. Like, do they learn different? You know, I'm just spitballing and you're like, yeah, I know. There's a million different things we could explore.
No, I think it's important. And actually, during COVID, we had to shut the lab down and we switched to doing studies on Zoom. And so we actually have some published studies that are from Zoom data. And I was really excited about that because then it's just from the comfort of your own home. And so we were able to get dogs that wouldn't have been comfortable enough to come into the lab. And we, with one of those studies, we replicated a previous study, which was nice to see. But it would be really interesting to, on Zoom studies, keep track of which dogs would have been able to come into the lab versus not and see if there's any differences.
Yeah, and I would imagine doing this virtually could expand the data set on such a enormous level, like versus just the Boston area. You could do yes. all over. But I would imagine that yes. you need a facilitator. Like this isn't just people record and send you clips. Like you get on Zoom.
You'd be surprised. I have, so the Zoom, I think for most studies you do need a Zoom component. But there's one population that I've worked with before actually that doesn't do well with now you're going to do it on Zoom, and that's cats. And so when we compare dogs and cats, it's actually better to do an asynchronous video upload because the owner can figure out like, okay, the cat is willing to participate right now. Because if you just say it's 7 o'clock on a Monday, okay, come here, kitty, kitty. Like the cat's not going to come
They're
over
like,
and
I'm
participate with
busy
you.
Right
I'm actually
now.
Busy right now. Yeah. So when we compare the dogs and cats, that's when I think it's a good idea to use the asynchronous video yeah. recording. But I like the Zoom for other things.
Yeah, for sure. And that way you can, I mean, being as I'm a virtual dog behavior consultant, so I also understand like the difference between what your instruction was and then what people's interpretation of your instruction was. So you can you can be on Zoom telling them, oh no, actually do it this way.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, I think it's definitely for me, most of the questions, there's some questions we can't even ask on Zoom because it's too complicated. Like the puzzles, sure. it would be too much to ship out a puzzle and explain how to be the experimenter and do all of that. So Zoom has its limits too.
Yeah, I would imagine. So you mentioned, you know, dogs are a great model for human learning. What Can you talk about some of the things that dogs have taught you about people?
Yes. So I think to returning to overimitation, just to kind of tie that back to what this is actually telling us about people, I think the way that this was when I first published my study about overimitation, the press picked it up and said, dogs are outsmarting human children because the dogs are leaving out these unnecessary steps. And on the one hand, yes, in the experiment, they were outsmarting the children. But if you think about the larger context of human culture, I think it actually starts to give us some hints about what might be supporting our human culture. So think about fire building, for instance. If you've ever tried to build a fire without matches and fuel, it's very complex. And in particular, if you have a flint, you have to keep striking the flint many, many times until you get a spark. And you have to pile brush up in a very particular way to allow for oxygen. Those steps might seem silly, right? Like, why is that person just smashing two rocks together? Mm-hmm. You know? So if you're overanalyzing it, you're going to leave out steps that are actually important. Think about also other examples are washing hands, brushing teeth. You don't know, you can't see germs, but they are there. And being able to just kind of accept what you're being shown and internalizing it and copying it can be beneficial for humans. So that's one thing that I've learned about humans is that sometimes things that seem maladaptive at a larger scale actually are adaptive. So that would be the main thing from overrotation, but trying to think of what else I've learned about humans. What I've learned about humans on a more kind of a different level is we are really ready to anthropomorphize, especially our dog. And I think that's been a really important thing for me also as a human to think about. Where there's some really lovely studies that were done by a few different researchers looking at the guilty look in dogs. And I don't know if you're familiar with this work at all, but essentially the dogs, when you come home and they've torn up something, they give you this look that really looks like they're feeling guilt. But time and time again, when it's investigated in the lab, it seems like it's more of an appeasement look, perhaps.
Yes.
That's not showing I've internalized that I've done something wrong and now I feel bad about it. It's showing I know you're upset and this face really helped lower that upset. And so I think that's one thing that we've learned is that we have to be careful about anthropomorphizing.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, certainly I'm familiar with that work with the guilty faces. And I, yes, have believed, like, even before that, I was always like, no, they're just, they know you're mad. And they're, they know how to respond to you when you're mad. But like, for me, it's like, and isn't it cool that they know that you're mad? And isn't it cool? To me, like, that in and of itself is cool enough. Like, they don't need to feel guilty. Like, it's interesting enough that they know that you're, because the reason people think they're guilty is because they come in and the dog looks that way before they start yelling or before they start freaking out. So there's something else going on that is, to me, the more interesting piece of, like, is there just a learning history of you coming home and being a jerk? And so therefore they're not sure yet if you're nice mommy or nice or mean mommy today. And like, so they're so like, to me, when we make them into tiny humans, we disregard how cool they actually are as their own selves, because dogs are interesting enough that they don't need to be humans. Which is why it's interesting.
That's really true.
Yeah. Like and that's actually why, like, this work you're doing is a young field, because for so long they weren't considered worthy of study. Like, they just weren't considered interesting enough. Actually, they're so interesting. Actually, the way that the fact that as young as 4 weeks, they can pick up on us trying to teach them things when deliberate teaching is not something that happens between dogs. Like, that's so interesting and cool and unique.
It really is. It's amazing what they can do.
Yeah. Like, they're amazing. We don't need to anthropomorphize them to think higher of them. Like, to me, they're so cool just in and of themselves. So I would imagine that your work has kind of enhanced maybe your relationships with dogs or people, or like understanding dogs or people. Can you talk about some of those experiences? Maybe they're yours. Maybe they're some of your co-scientists. I don't think that's a word.
Collaborators. Yes.
Thank you. Collaborators. That was the word I needed. Are there any kind of stories about that you can share?
I think that, well, on the very practical way, working with dogs so much has really changed the way that I interact with dogs. And I always tell my, we have all sorts of behavior trainings for my students. And so I think when you are coming to the dog from the perspective scientifically of, we're not taking anything at face value. We're not using our intuitions here. We're really trying to understand from the data what's going on. That fundamentally changes the way you approach dogs when you're interacting with them too, because I'm always a huge proponent of let the dog come to you. You know, don't just go up and pet dogs. Don't assume what they want. Try to read from their behavior. Are they trying to continue this interaction? Are they trying to end this interaction? And I think that approaching scientifically from that perspective of let's not take anything for granted really has changed the way that I interact with dogs. And I think has made it so that like dogs approach me on the street more than they used to. And it's not just because I smell like dogs, I don't think, but I would say that's the main difference.
It's like they probably approach you because you present as safe to them, because you aren't making these presumptions and you're not, you know, trying to interact with them. I experience that too, like just observing them and letting them kind of be the guide of the interaction is again more interesting than deciding what they are and what they like. You know, like we've all had the guy walk up and be like, oh, it's okay, I'm a dog guy, like everybody, all the dogs like me. We've all had this happen, and it's obnoxious. it's you deciding how this interaction will go, as opposed to allowing the dog the space to decide how the interaction will go. And
exactly.
I love that. And I think that your work can do that more, this kind of work can do that more broadly, like for people who have dogs to understand. Like, I think there are plenty of people who've got a dog on their couch right now who have no idea that the dog can do cool things like recognize pointing or use eye contact on purpose.
Yeah, we definitely have people that come in with their dogs, and after they leave, they say, wow, I had no idea that my dog could do all of this, because we so often, they're in such a human-centric world that when we actually put them in a dog-centric space, there's a lot that can come out.
I love that. That's actually a perfect place to wrap up, because that is the bold statement that I want to kind of put out into the world, is that allowing yourself to be in a more dog-centric space or mindset will show you things about them that you may never have seen. And how cool that all those people who get to come in and bring their dogs into your lab leave with an enhanced appreciation for this animal that lives in their home. That alone is worth it for each and every individual dog that gets to come through there. You know, even that alone, that aside from the cool research and the cool information, is so great. Angie, is there anything else that you would like to leave us with? Or are we good?
I think the main thing is people can bring their dogs in. We always have more space. So if you're in the Boston area, feel free to come on by.
I love that. Where can people find that information?
Yes, the website is sites.bc.edu/doglab.
And we will put that in the show notes for everybody so that they don't need to scramble to to write that down. We'll put that in the notes. And yes, if you're in the Boston area, go over there, get your dog involved. Sounds like it's a really fun thing. If you were down the street from me, I would bring you some dogs. Thank you so much, Angie, for having this conversation with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you'll rate, review, and subscribe wherever you heard this podcast. And don't forget to join Patreon at patreon.com/cogdogradio. And if you're interested in more content like the stuff you heard here, I hope you'll check out my online courses, my membership, and all of my offerings at my website, sarahstreming.com. See you there.